But these subtle changes in speech are really good indicators, again, of problems associated with cognitive function. So we've been studying individuals, healthy individuals, people who are suffering from mild cognitive impairment. Can we get them to do a series of speech tasks? Can we give them a page from a novel? Can they read that page and see how well they're actually being able to pronounce the words, being able to hold the rhythm, being able to hold the sentences and to be able to pronounce those words in and articulate those words successfully? We get them to also describe what they're seeing in a picture. So what are we seeing in this particular picture here? Is it mountains and tennis courts or football pitches and people playing football? How flexible are they to describe a picture that they've just been presented with? What's happening in that picture? And we can extract different measures using biomedical engineering methods. We can extract how many words they've used, how quick their articulation rate is, and are there many pauses between the words? What's the duration of their sentences they speak? So if you're speaking in a very slow rhythm with many gaps between the words, that's an indication that cognitive function could be reduced.
Hey there, friends. Welcome back to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew. On this podcast, we talk health, we talk well-being, Mondays and Thursdays. Over 360 episodes in the archive now. And by virtue of the huge increase in downloads in recent weeks and months, I'm presuming you're enjoying listening to some of the great interviews with the world-renowned experts in a variety of different fields, including psychology, philosophy, neuroscience, and many other topics. And if you're getting value from listening to these episodes, please like, subscribe, share, and leave the podcast a positive rating. 3, 4, or even 5 stars if you think that I have earned it. Now, you're probably familiar with having an MRI scan on your strained muscle. Your grandmother quite possibly had her hip replaced at some point, and more of us are wearing devices that can alert us of irregular heart-related events, which can prompt us to seek medical attention urgently. These are all everyday examples of how our lives intersect with biomedical engineering. As research in this area progresses and as technology improves, the field of bioengineering is only going to become more impactful in our lives. One of the people at the forefront of biomedical engineering research is Professor Richard Riley, who specialises in neural engineering at Trinity College in Dublin, where his research focuses on the processing of signals that diagnose the human physiological and cognitive state. And in this episode, we find out what exactly biomedical engineering is and how we interact with examples of it every day, quite often even without realising. We also discuss some of the 500 research studies Professor Riley has been involved in, including examining the walking stride and the cognitive functions of diabetes patients, who are at greater risk of cognitive decline than people who don't have diabetes. We discuss research that seeks to provide a predictor of Alzheimer's disease by studying the alteration in people's speech patterns over time. Expect to learn what role neural engineering is playing in helping us understand spinal cord injuries. We talk about how AI is already making a significant impact in the bioengineering space and the potential for it to accelerate progress as far as discovery and research are concerned. And we also ask if there are any ethical considerations to be aware of when carrying out research and developing new technologies in the bioengineering space. Well, Professor Richard Riley, you're very welcome to the podcast. Your special interest is neural engineering, which falls under the umbrella, the larger umbrella of bioengineering. I suppose to put things into context for people who aren't familiar with these terms, what exactly is bioengineering? And then more specifically, what is neural engineering?
Well, I suppose biomedical engineering is using engineering principles, so maths and physics, to be able to help understand problems in healthcare, so understand how the body might be not functioning to its best of its ability, and also maybe helping finding solutions to be able to treat those particular problems. So it has a very practical focus in terms of aiding healthcare and improving health of everybody, as well as understanding what those problems could be. And then within biomedical engineering, we have a range of different disciplines which have grown up over the last 10, 20, 30 years or so. One of those is an area that I'm particularly interested in, which is neural engineering. And that has to do with the nervous system, understanding how the nervous system functions And also, I guess it responds to a huge interest in all of us over the last maybe number of decades, understanding how the brain actually functions. So can we understand how the brain functions? If we understand a little bit better how that works, maybe then we can look at solutions of when it's not working. So really, neural engineering is bringing together neuroscientists, engineers, neurologists, psychiatrists, working together to be able to help in, and solve and understand problems associated with the brain and the nervous system in general.
And then are there any examples then of biomedical engineering, generally speaking, that you can give us that people would think, oh my goodness, yeah, that's, I never realized that was an example of something that people interact with or use in everyday life?
Yeah, well, I suppose we're probably all familiar with maybe two examples. One is probably in cardiology. So understanding how your heart is functioning. Many of us, as we go through life, go to see our GP and our possibly a cardiologist to understand we're in good cardiac health. So maybe if to how that imaging takes place, so being able to acquire images of the body and the heart inside the body and its functioning. So biomedical engineers, we'd be involved with physicists to understand how do we build machines to image inside the body with high resolution. And nowadays, the quality of those images is stunning that we can provide very detailed information to cardiologists to see how your heart is functioning well. If there's a problem and we need to maybe increase the blood flow in certain regions, inputting a stent to be able to expand out some of the arteries to be able to allow that blood flow and the pumping action of the heart to work well. So the design of those stents, the placement of those stents inside the body, all of that would be involved in the realm of biomedical engineering. And I guess many people also may be familiar with family members who maybe have had a hip implant or maybe a knee implant. And again, those systems of being able to provide mobility and increase flexibility and improve quality of life to individuals as a result of a hip implant, which nowadays is done so routinely that you're only in hospital for 1 or 2 days. Before you have to go for rehabilitation, and often that's based at home. So those kind of implants would also be examples of biomedical engineering. And those areas being well researched and are standard clinical practice nowadays. So we even don't think about them as in biomedical engineering prostheses.
You have co-authored a staggering 500 plus science papers. And if I can ask you about some of your research that you have been involved with, one very interesting study looked at how middle-aged people with and without type 2 diabetes walked. It looked at their gait and examined their cognitive function. Now, this sounds very interesting. What did this study involve and how was biomedical engineering employed in this particular context?
It's a fascinating study. And I guess it looks, I suppose, not trying to solve problems which already exist, but looking to see can we offset problems that could exist in the future. So a huge aspect and maybe a concern for many of us is as we get older, thinking of ourselves or our family members, cognitive function is a big challenge. Are we going to be cognitively healthy in the future? It's a concern that everybody has. We know that there are a number of different risk factors for cognitive function. We know that one of those risk factors is having diabetes. And people with diabetes are at increased risk of getting dementia later in life. So rather than waiting around for people to have that particular problem develop and looking for, now and frankly, there are very limited resources that can be applied to help somebody. Pharmacological interventions, for example, are very thin on the ground for helping people with dementias later in life. Would it not be better to try to look at those at risk early and try to trap very subtle changes that are maybe happening in middle age rather than later age and do something about it when we may have a chance to increase things in a non-pharmacological way? So this particular study that's still ongoing is, can we look at healthy, well-controlled people, but dealing with diabetes in a very controlled way? Can we see subtle changes in middle age, which might show risk factors for getting dementia in those individuals later in life? And what we've been looking at is the standard blood markers and other markers that you'd look at associated with diabetes, but also looking at light touch methods to assess cognitive function. So we've been particularly interested in looking at speech markers and cognitive function, subtle changes in speech, and also in this particular study, subtle changes in gait. We know that our ability to be able to do things, walk and talk at the same time, is something we all take for granted for most of us. But in fact, the ability for the brain to switch attention to be able to concentrate on walking while concentrating on talking or doing some other very complex cognitive task is a real subtle indicator of the brain's ability to be able to deal with these multimodal events. So this particular study looked at healthy individuals who are dealing with their diabetes. We're looking at subtle changes in gait, which might indicate who, maybe one or two of them, may be at risk of getting dementia later in life. And now could we apply all of our powers at middle age to be able to offset that risk later in life?
And what do those changes in gait look like, though? How do they characterize themselves?
Yes, no, absolutely. These are very subtle changes in gait. So we have a number of sensors that we can place on the body. And the person is doing a very simple task, getting out of a chair, walking a number of meters, turning around, coming back and sitting back in the chair. And what we're looking at here are subtle changes in stride lengths, sway left and right, for example, anterior posterior sway as they're walking along. So subtle changes in gait while they're walking, just simply walking, turning around and coming back, walking and then doing something a little bit more complex, maybe holding a glass of water almost filled up to the brim with the instruction, don't spill the water, but still do the walking task forward and backwards. Or else do the walking task while maybe repeating alternate letters of the alphabet. So these highly demanding cognitive tasks are going to force you to slow down. They may increase sway in different ways. And these changes in postural stability, changes in speed, are big indicators of changes in cognitive function. So we can see these subtle markers before they may manifest as some of the standard measures of cognitive function.
Really, really interesting. Another very interesting study I noticed on your website is that it involves postural instability and neuroprotective therapy in MS patients. Now, MS, multiple sclerosis, is obviously a terribly debilitating disease characterized by a loss of motor function. And again, can we talk about these terms, neuroprotective therapy? What is postural instability and how is biomedical engineering involved in this context?
So exactly, comes into to looking at a slightly different issue here. So we have some good therapies for MS and other conditions, which is terrific. And how do we titrate or personalize those medications for those individuals? That's really important. We have standard measures which are used across clinics worldwide to be able to assess different aspects of cognitive health and different aspects of physical health. But sometimes those measures are very broad, not very specific. So we may be solving one particular problem, but maybe causing other problems. So that could be a problem, for example, if we're giving some intervention and it's solving one problem, but it's making the patient very fatigued or causing some other cognitive burden, for example. So we don't want to solve one problem and cause another. Also, subtle aspects of quality of life. So the risk of falling, for example, is a big problem in patients with neurodegenerative diseases. How do we assess the risk of falls in the future? We can ask them, are you unstable? We can ask family members, but we'd like to have objective ways to be able to do that. And one simple way is standing on what looks like a weighing scales. It's a system for being able to measure postural stability. Stand still with your eyes open and eyes stand still with your eyes closed. And as we all close our eyes, we're going to have a little bit of postural instability, a little bit of sway in our posture. That's perfectly normal because we take a lot of sensory information in through vision and that helps us to maintain postural stability. So we were looking at control subjects, but also patients who are in the MS clinic to be able to see, is there increased postural instability in those patients? If there is, maybe they may be at risk of falls in the future. And as a result, maybe increased physiotherapy might be beneficial to be able to reduce that risk of falls. And we know falls has a huge impact on quality of life. Often people end up being institutionalized as opposed to living at home successfully, independently. So we want to be able to reduce the risk of falls as best as possible. So this very simple measure of being able to look at postural sway, so the movement as your eyes are open and eyes are closed. And again, rather like the previous study I mentioned, we had those subjects doing a very complex cognitive task at the same time. So maybe subtracting the number 7 from 100 and going all the way backwards and seeing as it gets more complex and we're all making mistakes as we're doing this, does our postural sway start to increase? And could this be a subtle measure that we're putting more focus on attending to the mathematical task than maintaining our stability? Hopefully all of us were able to keep both going at the same time. But we're looking to see, are you putting more focus on the cognitive task and less on the movement task? And that could be a subtle indicator of somebody maybe at risk of falling. So my team and I had some great researchers working on that study, and we're able to record postural stability from these sensor devices that we're able to place underneath their feet. So as you stood up on what looked like a weighing scales, we're able to take data from that subject. And also from sensors that we placed on the body to be able to see very quickly if there is postural instability. And that would give indication then to the clinicians, maybe we should be recommending some increased physiotherapy for this particular patient to reduce any possible risk of falls in the future.
Another study which really leapt off the page whenever I read about it looked at spinal cord stimulation and motor responses in individuals with spinal cord injury. This sounds especially interesting. Could you tell me a little bit about this? And then could you speculate then as to whether you believe bioengineering or biomedical engineering and neural engineering at some point will contribute to resolving paralysis in patients?
That obviously would be fantastic. And there's some great teams worldwide working on that particular problem, trying to solve those issues. Now, there's a number of different problems there. One is to understand the injury itself. Not all injuries are exactly the same, so everybody's injuries is slightly different. Understanding the biology of how neurons can regrow again after injury, that's a huge challenge. But we know that for some individuals, electrical stimulation along the spine can help improve mobility. So there are Parkinsonian patients who have done a huge benefit from having spinal stimulation to improve overall stability and overall mobility. So their quality of life tends to improve. One of the aspects we were looking at in this particular study was that where should we apply the stimulation along the spine? How often should we apply that stimulation? And should that stimulation be changed during different types of movements? So we were particularly concerned with a very simple movement that all of us complete during the day, but in fact is really difficult for many people and really affects their quality of life, is getting out of a chair from a sitting position to a standing position. And applying electrical stimulation along the spine with a series of electrodes and injecting some current in along the spine to provide extra drive to drive those muscles to get you to go from a sitting position to a standing position is very difficult. A number of reasons is, of course, as we stand up, as we're moving, our spine is changing. And those electrical electrodes on the surface of the spine are further away from the neurons that they're trying to integrate with. So how can we inject the current into specific neurons to drive those muscles? So our study here was to see how could we model the movement from a sitting position to a standing position? How could we inject the current through a series of external electrodes placed on the surface of the spine to be able to boost the person from a sitting position to a standing position in a very efficient way?
Really fascinating. And I suppose being able to resolve that issue of paralysis in spinal cord injury patients is really one of the holy grails of this whole area.
Absolutely. And there are colleagues in other institutes and universities working on different growth factors to help improve the ability of nerves to be able to grow in particular directions, maybe to diffuse together with other nerves across the break, for example, that could be in the spinal cord. But also it comes into other areas as well for people who may have some back injuries, not as severe maybe as any difficulties associated with the spinal cord, but maybe muscular issues of putting their back out as a result of sports injuries or other activities. Looking to see how do we move from a sitting to a standing position in a very efficient ways. So we're trying to look at that in patients with Parkinson's disease at the moment in a study, patients with other movement disorders. How can we have very simple sensors that can be placed on the body to be able to look at the efficiency of doing these very simple movements? We often, of course, testing patients in the hospital when they come in to see their health professional. But often we'd like to know, how do they get on at home? Could we record that data at home? So the use of nowadays sensors that can be are very cheap, very easy to attach maybe on a belt or some kind of belt buckle that you can wear at home. That information can provide a huge amount of information to healthcare professionals. So how are you actually getting on at home, getting out of the chair if you're turning on the TV or turning off the TV or moving around the kitchen, for example, as opposed to just being observed for a number of minutes in the outpatient department? So this background information on sitting and standing and moving has implications for a number of different areas. And this kind of longitudinal monitoring is really, I think, going to be a key in the future.
We touched upon cognitive decline earlier in the conversation. Can I talk specifically about early detection approaches for Alzheimer's as regards impairment of cognition and speech are concerned? I know you're involved in a study on that area at the moment. Can you give us any details at all on that study?
Exactly. And it comes back to maybe what I spoke to before, is that rather than try to solve the problem once the problem has occurred, can we look at problems before they occur? So again, looking at cognitive function, and again, as we age, we hopefully will all age successfully and gracefully. Some of us might age a little bit more rapidly. And as a result, can we see that rapid change in aging sooner to be able to do something about it? So these light touch methods or simple ways that we can acquire information about cognitive function are very interesting. And one of these that we've been looking at for a little while is speech. So we know that if we're had a good night's sleep and we're well rested, we've got good use of frequencies in our voice. We can change our rhythm and our prosody goes up and down as we're speaking. But we know that if we've had a very bad night's sleep or we've been out at a dinner last night or a party, probably the next day we're speaking in a very almost monotonous type voice and we've got bigger gaps between the words. And that's a real indication of we're fatigued, our cognitive function is down, we're trying to recover and get back to our normal selves. But these subtle changes in speech are really good indicators, again, of problems associated with cognitive function. So we've been studying individuals, healthy individuals, people who are suffering from mild cognitive impairment. Can we get them to do a series of speech tasks? Can we give them a page from a novel? Can they read that page and see how well they're actually being able to pronounce the words, being able to hold the rhythm, being able to hold the sentences and to be able to pronounce those words in and articulate those words successfully? We get them to also describe what they're seeing in a picture. So what are we seeing in this particular picture here? Is it mountains and tennis courts or football pitches and people playing football? How flexible are they to describe a picture that they've just been presented with? What's happening in that picture? And we can extract different measures using biomedical engineering methods. We can extract how many words they've used, how quick their articulation rate is. Are there many pauses between the words? What's the duration of their sentences they speak? So if you're speaking in a very slow rhythm with many gaps between the words, that's an indication that cognitive function could be reduced. But we can look at very subtle changes. It may not appear to other individuals that there's a subtle change, but with our computer methods, we can extract those over time. And so we could see that Richard today was speaking at this particular rate, but over the last couple of months, that rate has suddenly started to go down and the prosody, the rhythm of his voice is going down. This could be an indicator that there's some subtle changes in cognitive function that might warrant further investigation. So we're looking for early subtle changes in cognitive function that might be important. And this is huge implications in the future. If we these studies and we and others around the world are looking at these speech-based measures for cognitive function, that maybe the likes of Alexa at home, for example, might suddenly recognize that we're speaking slightly different, asking for things, for example, or even our mobile phone companies are recognizing that the speech that we're using is slightly different. So there are many ways that we can acquire this data in normal daily use that might be useful for show us biomarkers of the future to see, oh, I was great last year, but I'm seeing a little bit different. But now we can actually see hard evidence for seeing that.
It's so encouraging. The potential is huge. You mentioned earlier about the interdisciplinary approach to your work. You work alongside gerontologists, neurologists and lots of other experts. What are the benefits of this?
The bit is, it's fascinating working with these people. So for me, that's the big thing. It's working alongside learning another discipline is the bit that I've always been excited about. And I've been very lucky working both in Ireland and abroad of working with some fantastic people across so many different disciplines. That I really enjoy. So going to their particular hospital or their particular clinic or their outpatients department, seeing patients and seeing how they're trying to challenge and deal with coming up with diagnosis or titrating the medications or different types of interventions, and seeing how we could do that from an engineering point of view. Could we improve their ability to be able to do that particular task? So I find that aspect fascinating. And I've been very fortunate to have some fantastic PhD students and master's students and postdoc researchers working with me over the years. And they tend to find that fascinating also. So if they enjoy being in the clinic, meeting with patients and understanding the vocabulary that's talked about in these meetings, they really can get it and say, well, we've got these engineering methods. We can really apply this. We can get something actually working. So I find that the most fascinating part of our understanding that. It's forced me to learn new vocabulary. So, of course, every medical discipline has its own vocabulary, which is very specific and very detailed to describe different issues. I find that fascinating to learn that. And I have now doing this for many years. It's still fascinating. There's always going to be something new and new people coming through with new challenges and new problems. So there's just not enough time in the day to work on all the challenges, and it's such interesting problems to work on.
It's a good problem to have. I'm curious as to whether there are any ethical considerations when it comes to performing research or developing technologies in this space.
It's yeah, absolutely. And that's all based on patient safety, not putting people at risk in any particular way, or changing any aspect of personal dignity or anything. So we go through ethical performance reviews, both in the hospital if we're acquiring data from patient subjects. And of course, they're all volunteers. They may be patients, but they still have to volunteer to be part of these studies. So we have to respect that. So we have ethical approval in the health institutions, the hospitals themselves. We in the university would have to go through a separate research ethics approval process as well for these studies. And that can be burdensome in terms of the amount of paperwork that we have to do, but hugely beneficial, because before we do the study, you're thinking, well, why do we need to do this? Is that really important? Should we be acquiring some other information? Could we have that information? Do we need to ask the subject again for this information? So going through that particular process allows us to be able to really drill down into the exact experiment that we're trying to do to make sure that it's probably the best thing that we can actually implement. So it's very beneficial. And of course, it's there for patient safety point of view. Absolutely. And also then, if there are medical devices that are developed, they have to go through the regulatory process as well. So we have to apply through the authorities. So here it's the healthcare, the Health Products Regulatory Authority, the HPRA, who would oversee the regulation of products that are used in healthcare facilities. So all of those devices have to be approved to be able to be applied to patients in that way. So they're very strict research ethical processes and regulatory process for medical devices, as it should be. It's all about patient safety and making sure that the devices and the systems that are used are clinically efficient. They're actually doing something of clinical benefit. So it can be burdensome paperwork, but it's there for the right reasons.
How do you think artificial intelligence will help you and others in the biomedical engineering space?
It's already making a difference, a positive difference, and has done for some time. So can we filter through large volumes of data in maybe more efficient ways to pick up subtle differences in cues? That's really important. So I see that's going to be a huge issue. So we talk about patients with large paper files and systems, and it's so difficult to be able to have people go through each of those files to pick up subtle differences. If they were all electronic records and we could have an AI system to trawl through your medical records over the last number of years, maybe there might be subtle things that might be there, might be in to help us in terms of diagnosis. So those things are going to be hugely important once we have electronic patient records across the country and in large volumes. I think also we can use artificial intelligence in the developing country. So we have lots of expertise here in developed countries that maybe that doesn't translate as easily to developing countries. And maybe AI could be of great benefit in those countries to be able to use the expertise that's in developed countries to be able to help in diagnosis in developing countries. So I think it works. It can be working in both ways in that regard. So huge advantages. There are problems, of course. Often we don't fully understand, even as mathematicians or as engineers or as clinicians, what actually is the AI doing mathematically? How is it coming up with that particular answer? So the big challenge and a big area of concern is explainable artificial intelligence. Why did it come up with that answer? Can we look back at, okay, we can see mathematically why it did that. Therefore, yes, it's come up with the right conclusions as opposed to jumping to the wrong conclusion. So fully explainable AI, I think, is going to become much more prevalent. And we hear that in the public media all the time now. That's going to be much more prevalent in healthcare. And looking at the efficacy of applying artificial intelligence from a regulatory point of view, that's also going to become much more of a concern. And I think we're going to see much more positive benefits, as I say, not just in the developed countries, but also in developing countries, of using AI to be able to support their increasing healthcare concerns.
It's a question that I've asked many experts in recent months, and I think many of them have good things to say about the potential for AI. But obviously, we need to take into consideration the negative implications too. And obviously, we also mentioned to the ethical considerations, because I presume they will come up also whenever you involve artificial intelligence.
Absolutely. So, and that can be often a problem for research ethics committees to be able to fully understand how is this being applied? How do we know that that data is not going to be shared with others, for example? How are you training your system? So, for example, there are many AI systems that if you search on the internet, you'll find many of them that maybe you feed in some data and it'll give you a diagnosis. But maybe that's trained in a very completely different data set. So there are great concerns, for example, of maybe using wearable devices like Fitbits or Garmin watches, et cetera, to detect different cardiac events from your movement data or your heart data. And they've undergone a huge amount of research, ethical and regulatory processes to make sure that the device is trained on somebody of your age to be able to come up with a diagnosis for somebody like you, as opposed to being trained on 20-somethings from a research lab and applied to data recorded from people in their 80s. That just wouldn't be ethically correct and probably wouldn't give the right answer anyway. So there's big concerns in the research ethical approval process to be able to make sure that the training and the building of these systems is done correctly. And that causes problems to make sure that the people on those research ethics committees have that expertise. And that can often be difficult to find those people.
As I said earlier, you've been involved in co-authoring over 500 papers, which is just staggering. If I had to pin you down, if I had to pressure you into making a choice, which body of research or which study are you most proud of?
Very difficult. I don't know. They're all fascinating. I'm lucky in the lab at the moment. I think we have around 14 people. All of those projects are fascinating. They're all fascinating. I suppose it's moving, getting them actually being used in the clinic. That's of great advantage. And that can take an awful long time. It doesn't happen overnight. And it often happens many years after a PhD student has finished their work that it finally ends up in the clinic or being used. But I think it's not really the project that I'm most proud of. It's the people we've generated that I'm most proud of, where they've gone on afterwards from being in the lab, coming in as a very small junior student, maybe helping out for a couple of weeks in the summer in the lab, to go on to be a consultant in a particular area afterwards and still being involved in these kind of areas. So the projects are the projects, but I'm more proud of the people that we've produced. I think that's what I'm most proud of.
Well, it's a really fascinating subject and it involves so many different disciplines. As I mentioned, all of your research papers are on your website. I'll pop a link to that website in the show notes for this episode. But for the moment, thank you for the work that you're doing. I wish you continued success in the future. And thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Great. Thank you so much for your interest. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you for tuning into this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you're enjoying or getting any value at all from tuning in, please like, subscribe on whatever platform you're listening, and share with people in your lives who you think might get value from tuning in also. And a reminder, we're on YouTube and on Instagram. So if you want to check out the videos of these podcast episodes, you can do so just by searching for the Happy Habit Podcast on those platforms. Until next time, stay happy.